Hello and welcome back to yet another episode of the VC Pruner podcast, a podcast that provides a unique perspective of the startup world through the lens of venture capitalists and entrepreneurs. I am your host Digjay, and today I have with me Anubhav Jain, co-founder and CEO at Tripify, the fintech startup that provides micro, small and medium-sized enterprises find suitable financing on digital B2B platforms and marketplaces. In this episode, Anubhav talks about his path leading up to founding Tripify, the recent positives and challenges faced by SMEs, what is embedded finance and some of its use cases, Tripify's cash flow-based embedded lending model, importance of speed at early stage startups, what founders should optimize for between seed and series A rounds, role of early stage investors in raising subsequent funding rounds, and more. I absolutely enjoyed my chat with Anubhav, and I would strongly recommend all early stage startups to listen to this episode, which is packed with insights on all aspects of venture building. So without much ado, let's jump in and find out what Anubhav has to share. Hey Anubhav, welcome to the VC Pruner podcast. Excited to have you with us today.
Hi Digjay, thanks for having me and equally excited to have this conversation.
Awesome. And for our listeners who don't know you yet, maybe you know we can start with a brief background about yourself and tell us the path that you took leading up to Tripify.
Sure. So firstly, not so exciting stuff, engineer MBA, like many other people in the country. But post that, from the campus, took one of the not so very common paths. I started with risk management. So my career has been in financial services all throughout, almost 13 and a half years now. So I worked with American Express. I worked with Citibank for a good 7 years, doing consumer and commercial risk. That brought me a lot of insights into how financial services works from a risk management and credit risk, data analytics standpoint. This was all for the US market. And after working for the US market for a long time, I saw that there is definitely an opportunity for me to do something in the Indian context. So I decided to do a fintech for consumer lending. This was back in 2015. In between, I had done a small edtech startup, which did not do that well. I decided education was not my cup of tea. Financial services is where I wanted to stay. So did this consumer lending startup called Cubera, ran it for 3.5 years, ton of learnings during that journey. We launched and scaled to a 250 crore loan book where we were running a managed marketplace for salaried personal loans. Pretty positive unit economics, some of the best arrangements in terms of risk and revenue sharing with the top banks in the country. Finally, Cubera got acquired by Incred. And that was the time when I was looking to do something next, which is even bigger, creating more value, creating more impact. And that's when I saw that while financial services is a huge area, but consumer fintech is still very well captured or tapped by entrepreneurs and by companies at this point. The scope for incremental innovation, if you ask me, in consumer fintech, I could see that to be limited. But if it comes to fintech for MSMEs, that's where the slate is wide open. That's where the potential is huge and the market is still untapped to a large extent. And that's how, you know, we came down to this whole target segment of MSMEs. So early 2020 is when, after close to around an year of whiteboarding and trying out different ideas, final idea of Tripify came about, that we wanted to help SMEs get access to financial products, credit being right at the top. And we thought that we will do it in a way which is efficient from a customer acquisition standpoint and from a underwriting or data access standpoint. So the one thing that was clear to us is that if you're going after SMEs, you need to bring down your costs, because SMEs means lower ticket sizes. Lower ticket sizes means limited scope to make money. And if that's limited, then how do you make sure that your unit economics makes sense? So that's how the whole business model of doing it the embedded way came about. And we thought that that's the best way to go about extending financial products to SMEs, because if you go embedded, you reduce your cost. Mm-hmm. You basically work with a partner where you are embedding your technology. So that's how the idea of Tripify came about.
Right. And, you know, very interesting background. I want to touch upon multiple topics there. You know, your founder journey, mm-hmm. one failed startup, one exit, and this is your third startup. And then, of course, want to talk more about Groupify.
Sure.
Like you mentioned, you know, the embedded finance aspect and the approach toward distributing a product. But before that, you know, I want to talk about the target market for Groupify, you know, which, like you mentioned, the MSMEs in India and Southeast Asia. And you've watched this space closely, right, over the past few years. So according to you, you know, zooming out, what have been the, you know, key positive changes that you've seen in the sector, you know, over the last 5 years? And on the flip side, what are the existing challenges still need to be addressed when it comes to MSMEs?
Sure. When we talk about MSMEs, one thing, Digya, that we all need to keep in mind is the way you define this whole MSME term, it's very loose in India. A 5 crore turnover business is also classified under MSME, and a 100 crore turnover business is also classified under MSME definition. And that's slightly weird or bizarre because both of these are very different entities. Somebody who's who's running a 100 crore turnover business, the kind of capital they have, the kind of expenses they would have on working capital, on capex, etc., is completely different from a small retailer who's running a shop with sub 2 crore kind of an annual turnover. So that, I think, is the biggest challenge right now, is that how do you really define this segment? And I'll talk about the challenges first and maybe then come up with some positives as to why things are changing and how things are changing now. So that's number one. I think when one talks about MSME as a target segment, you need to really drill down to what part of MSME segment are you going after. So for Groupify, we are very clear that any business with below 5 crore turnover is our target. We will not go behind a business. And we're not saying that there's no need there or there's no potential there, but we will not go after the mid to large size businesses. We are focusing on the more long tail of businesses. I think challenge-wise, or where MSMEs or targeting MSMEs is difficult today, is that the moment you talk about a business entity, getting data is very difficult. So think about an MSME in the way that you are trying to offer them a financial product. A simple thing like KYC is very, very cumbersome. We have different entities in India like proprietorships, partnerships, and private limited entities. Now, a proprietorship may be still an easier nut to crack, but when it comes to a private limited or a partnership entity, RBI lists down the KYC requirements in a way that you just can't imagine doing the entire onboarding journey end to end in a digital way, because RBI asks you for a proof of ownership, list of directors or partners, a board resolution that, you know, authorizes one of the directors or partners to borrow or take credit on behalf of the entity, and many other things, you know. So how do you really go about executing all that in a digital way? So that's, I think, one big challenge which is currently being solved. Other than that, a major challenge is that even though there is some ray of light that's coming in the form of digitization of payments and UPI and demonetization driving a lot of digital economy, but still MSMEs, if you see, especially the long tail that we transact with, a large part of their business is in cash. And because of that, if I'm using their financial statements to underwrite them, I'm looking at grossly underreported revenue or grossly underreported income, right? So from that fact, to do a correct evaluation of that SME is always very difficult, because you will not find all their transactions in bank statements or financial statements. So that's also a challenge that anybody who's trying to offer a financial product to an SME will face. The third is because they're not part of formal financial ecosystem. I think the tendency to pay on time all your accounts payables is still not there. So that education about how does it impact a credit bureau, how does timely payments lead to a good credit score, where the credit score is finally going to be helpful in you getting more credit in the future. That kind of education needs to happen. That kind of awareness needs to be created. It's there in the Indian salaried consumer mindset, but it's not in the Indian SME or the business owner kind of an ecosystem. So these are some areas where I do see there are challenges. But on the other side, there are some positives. First is definitely penetration of digital payments. I think COVID has amplified that to a large extent, where even a business in the remotest part who you could not have even imagined that they would have a bank account. They have all gone digital. I've been traveling for the last 2 weeks across some of the small towns of Karnataka. And I see that even on deserted roads and highways where you will find a small shop, you are likely to get them to accept digital payments. So from that perspective, I think there is a shift towards digitization of these transactions. There are initiatives as well. For example, the account aggregator framework that's coming up will help in making sure that some of this underwriting challenge of getting financial statements or GST transactions or any kind of data about an entity can be solved in a more standardized way. Government is making GST e-invoicing mandatory for businesses in a phased manner, but it will eventually happen for everybody. I think that's also a good move towards making sure that all sorts of B2B transactions are now being captured in an electronic format. In fact, if you ask me, Digjay, the biggest issue I see that we are trying to solve is that UPI has changed the way P2P and P2M payments happen. But when it comes to B2B payments, it's still largely offline. Right? You still see two businesses exchanging UTR numbers and asking for time of payment and what account they have used, what mode of payment they have used to make a transaction. That's, I think, big challenge when it comes to MSMEs doing transactions. So a lot of things are now changing, like digital contracts, click wrap agreements, digital signature, all of these are acceptable. So a lot of your credit onboarding is changing. Video KYC has come in. So part of, your physical KYC needs are also being changed. So RBI is progressive to some extent, but I think there is still a long way to go. So yeah, that's broadly where I see the MSME space from our perspective.
Yeah, and you rightly mentioned, right? The access to the MSMEs has been limited more because they've been outside the formal sector itself. There's no way to track data. Before, UPI came in, before digitization and the payment options have come up, account aggregator, which is going to, transform things. So now there's a lot more formalization of the economy that's happening, and that's going to help, a lot of startups, a lot of players like yourself to serve these MSMEs better,
right,
and solve for their challenges. So, speaking to that, could you share, what exactly is the challenge that Rupify is trying to solve for these MSMEs today? And a follow-up would be, how is Rupify's approach different from, some of the other players that are trying to solve the same problem?
Sure. Yeah, so carrying forward from what we were just talking about, I think one thing that was clear to us is there is no way that we can go and create access for MSMEs when it comes to underwriting based on financial statements. Because traditionally, and this is where, we would say we are different. I won't say we are the only ones doing it, but definitely trying to create a difference there, is that traditionally banks, NBFCs, and some fintechs as well, they underwrite based on balance sheets. What we have realized is that these SMEs, because of cash business and because of their size, they don't really have balance sheets for you to underwrite. So what we have adopted is a pure cash flow based underwriting model, that when I look at a small business, I am going to assess that business based on their short and medium term cash flows. We are not looking at their 3-year income tax returns. We don't ask for their last 2 years audited financials. We just look at their most recent cash flows and try and understand and predict what the future cash flows could look like. And can I take a bet based on that? So I think that's number one, that from an underwriting standpoint, Rupify is built on purely cash flow based underwriting model. If I talk about essentially what we are doing is, as I said, we've decided to take an embedded route. So when we say we want to give MSMEs access to credit, what we realized is there are two reasons or two main areas where MSMEs could need credit for. One is to manage the working capital gap created because of delayed payments from their customers to whom you are selling a product or service. The second is to manage purchases that you need to create that product or service for your customer. So what we decided is that the first use case we will try and solve is this whole purchase financing for SMEs. And we'll go after the traders and the manufacturing kind of sectors on day one. And because now post-COVID, a lot of B2B transactions have gone digital and across sectors, whether it's FMCG, medical, agriculture, construction materials, fashion, across all these sectors, a lot of digital B2B marketplaces have come up. So we decided that, hey, we will go and embed buy now, pay later kind of a product on B2B marketplaces and offer it to their SME customers. The beauty of this product is that unlike a consumer buy now, pay later, which assesses the customer independently and gives them the flexibility to buy on different marketplaces or e-commerce platforms, the SME BNPL works in a very closed loop, end use specific fashion. So, I mean, just to take an example, if there is a small FMCG Kirana store, we give them an exposure or a credit line to buy from a particular B2B marketplace. And that limit is specific to that particular marketplace because it's purely underwritten based on cash flows or transactions. So if I am a Kirana store and I buy from two different marketplaces and one distributor on a monthly basis, Rupify will go and see this Kirana store's transactions on all these three independently and try and assess how much credit we should give him on each of these platforms. If we see enough transaction history on, let's say, two out of these three, we will give him credit. And for the third one, we'll say, hey, we believe that can be managed through your free cash. So as a whole, we are trying to get as much share of the SME's wallet and give them that short-term credit for managing all their purchases. So that's the initial use case that we have at Rupify. And the difference clearly is that A, we do cash flow based underwriting. B, it's completely embedded inside the marketplace.
I think that's a, you know, very unique approach. Like you pointed out, you know, there's generally independent background check that happens, but not on platform to platform basis and based on the volume or the cash flows, you know, that a merchant is seeing on different platforms. That's definitely unique. You know, and SMEs are playing a big role in the Indian economy. They contribute close to 40-50%, you know, to our overall GDP and also employ close to that percent of the working population.
Yeah.
And, you know, we spoke about some of the challenges earlier. One of the biggest challenges has been to create solutions that serve these markets and kind of, you know, cater to the demand, especially the credit demand from these SMEs. And one way to access this demand is to solve for distribution. And like you mentioned, the embedded route is kind of a channel to get access to that distribution. Instead of, you know, having standalone lending products, you know, embedded solution is an easier and a frictionless way to get access to that SME and, you know, serve your financial solution to them. So for the benefit, you know, of our listeners, could you help explain, you know, what exactly is embedded finance in a nutshell? And what kind of a difference do you see, you know, with the distribution of financial services using this approach?
Sure. So embedded finance, while this term has been gaining a lot of popularity of late, but it has always existed, right? For, I think for a decade, there have been examples of embedded finance that have been there in the market. It's just that with growing competition and with rising costs of distribution, it has become even more important for everybody to look at embedded finance as a way to monetize. So essentially what embedded finance is all about is that, let's say there are two entities, one a customer and a service provider or a product. The whole purpose of selling a product to a customer is to make money. Now, what more and more companies are realizing as they go forward is a single product at many times does not create enough stickiness or does not create enough monetization for you, right? Because of various reasons. It could be because you have higher costs of distribution, so it's very difficult to cover those costs through just the life cycle of one single product. So what a lot of these non-financial product and service companies are doing is they are using financial products to increasingly monetize their existing customers. It makes a lot of sense because financial products are based on trust. And the trust level that, you know, traditional banks and NBFCs have in the minds of a consumer or an SME have not been built on the first principles. A lot of the non-financial product companies, like, for example, an Amazon or an Uber, have built that trust but through a non-financial use case. And now that they have the trust, now that they have the customer, it's easier for them to monetize by selling them a financial product, which is critical to their business, So to take an example, the whole buy now, pay later use case is the simplest example of a credit a product embedded inside an otherwise shopping use case. So an Amazon was just selling different products on its marketplace and consumers like you and me are buying. But then Amazon realized that, hey, if I have to continue to monetize this customer or if I have to give the option to buy to more customers who are landing on my website, can I give them the option to buy on EMIs? So it was a very obvious use case for someone like an Amazon to just say that when you select a product and go to the payment page, there is an embedding of a buy now, pay later product inside that payment page. So that creates a customer wow factor because the customer is delighted to see that, hey, maybe I was not in a comfortable position to buy this television or this particular electronics item using the money that I have. But now that I have this option to pay it in 3 or 6 equal monthly installments, I will definitely try and make that purchase. So it's a win-win for everybody. It's a win for Amazon or whoever the marketplace is. It's definitely a win for the customer because they get that credit option which they were looking for, but they were not able to get in the usual customer journey. And it's a win for the financial provider because they have got their customer without incurring too much acquisition cost. So there is no advertising that the financial partner has to do. There is no operating expense towards onboarding this customer. It's a very simple use case. In a few clicks, everybody is able to monetize this customer for their benefit, right? So that's just a very simple credit use case for embedding. Similarly, I think I've spoken about this on LinkedIn and social media that how cab companies like Ola Cabs have embedded a simple insurance product against missed flight. So what these companies would have seen is that a lot of customers are using cabs to go from the center of the city to the airport, which may be very far from where you are working. And invariably, you can't really estimate how much time it's going to take, especially in peak hours to reach the airport. And a lot of people may miss their flights if that estimate is wrong, or they may have to really buffer a lot of time, which is very inefficient for everybody. So what Ola did is they added a very simple and very economical missed flight insurance that, hey, whenever somebody books a flight, books a cab to the airport, they know that this person would be going there to take a flight. There is a chance that the customer can probably miss his flight because of, you know, traffic or other reasons. So can I give them an insurance against a fee where if they make up on time to the airport, that's great. That's incremental revenue for both the insurance provider and the cab provider. And if they miss, then it's a customer delight because now the customer has at least monetarily some comfort of, you know, booking an alternate option. So that's broadly, you know, two use cases of how simple financial products can be embedded by companies which are otherwise not doing anything in financial services. Like Amazon is a pure seller marketplace and Ola Cabs is a cab provider, but both of them have integrated financial products for their customer.
Yeah, and like you said, it's serving all the three stakeholders involved, right? For the customer, it's, you know, value-added services.
Yeah.
For the app, like an Ola or an Amazon, as we discussed, it's, you know, different means to monetize the user than the core use case that they have. And for a third party, you know, like Rupify, it's lower cost of acquiring a customer and serving the use case that they, you know, really are building toward.
Absolutely.
So that explains, you know, Rupify's approach and how you're planning to distribute and acquire your customers. You know, I want to shift gears a bit and talk about the founder experience and talk about your experience of building Rupify from scratch. And a lot of founders face this, you know, dilemma when they have an idea. You know, how do you go about building an MVP, you know, going from idea to MVP? So could you share, you know, what was your approach towards validating this idea of Rupify, and how did you go about building the MVP for Rupify?
Sure. So I think, Digjay, this has been probably a learning also from my previous startup experience that as you get an idea, I mean, it's always very likely that a founder gets emotionally so invested in that idea that they tend to ignore a lot of market forces or where exactly, you know, you can validate that idea before taking full plunge. So this time, what I did is me and my co-founders, we spent around 15 months looking at and getting market feedback on the product that we had initially thought for Rupify. So this is not the exact idea we had on day one. So end of 2018 is when we came together and we started exploring what we can do for MSMEs. And we started with various ideas. We looked at, can we do something where we can directly target these SMEs, or can we do something where we can do pure working capital loans, which are longer tenure for these MSMEs. And we started looking at these ideas one by one, putting them on a whiteboard and trying to talk to, let's say, 10, 20 sample set of customers to understand if there is immense value or there is enough market out there for us to do this. And also talking to some of the investors we had in our network who we knew that, hey, does this sound like there is enough meat in this business? Do you see competition out there? What has been your take based on your portfolio companies trying to do something similar? So I think it was a good 15 months of research that we did. At least 4 or 5 times we went back to the drawing board, completely changed the plot. I mean, you can call it pivoting, but we were still, you know, in the idea stage. So we could always say that, hey, this idea does not work. Let's tweak it. Let's look at it differently. And only after we got our first 2 customers, wherein the first 2 large marketplaces agreed that, yes, this is a large opportunity. We have been looking for a partner in these areas. So let's try and do something. Only then, you know, we decided that, okay, now let's try and build an MVP to offer to these 2 marketplaces where we have initial interest. So that's where I think the idea started shaping up. In fact, the first customer that we have was one of India's largest food tech startups that you have, where they wanted this credit kind of a facility, 15 or 30 days for their SME customers to pay for their B2B product. So we could clearly see that there is an opportunity that we can work on. We created the very basic product. In fact, if you look at that MVP that we had back in July 2020 to compare it to what we have now, there is a stark difference in where we have reached today. I think it was very important for us to come up with a very quick, maybe slightly scrappy, but something that really worked, kind of an MVP. So we got, in fact, initially, we were just a team of 4 engineers. So the design part, the UX part, we got it done through a consultant, because we were not sure whether we should get somebody full-time to do designing and the user experience. Since we knew that this is more like a pilot, we are first testing. If it works, then we'll do a full-blown design. So we got the first design created through one of my co-founder's friends. We rolled it out with the first 2 marketplaces. The first product was created more in a semi-automatic, semi-manual mode, where part of the journey was digital, part of the journey was handled by us at the back end. I mean, for the customer, it was still an end-to-end digital journey, but there were some manual checks we were running at the back. So we created the MVP in that way. Good thing, or the thing that I learned from my past mistake at Cubera, was that at Cubera, I think we took way too much time rolling out the first version of product. And I think the MVP, once you are clear on your idea, should be out in the market in days. And if not days, then maybe a few weeks, not more than that. So we were fortunate that we were clear that there are 2 customers who are ready to work with us. So 4 engineers and the co-founders, we worked together. And we rolled out an MVP in 6 to 7 weeks time since we raised our first round. And that received good response from these 2 marketplaces. And then we decided that, hey, now we can scale this, offer it to others, reach out to more people and scale this from there.
You mentioned a very interesting point, right? Validating your idea and going to MVP, that should be a shorter journey rather than spending a lot of time there and iterating.
Yeah.
And I think you were probably able to do that because you spent enough time before, you know, in the process of validating the idea itself and talking to the key stakeholders, you know, including customers, potential investors. So it's kind of a tricky, you know, time management, I would say, in a way, where spending more time on the validation helps in the long term when you have to, you know, actually roll out the MVP and test your products in market.
Right. And I think there's no right or wrong here, I think. But one thing that I've learned is whether it's the initial validation of your idea or the MVP, speed matters everywhere in a startup. The way the economy and the world is changing today, you can make mistakes, but you can't recover if you're not fast enough, right? You can recover from your mistakes later, but if you're slow, it makes it very difficult for a company to recover from lack of speed. So I think that's something that I had learned from Kubera, because in Kubera as well, I think we were one of the first ones to do that managed marketplace kind of a thing for the kind of ticket size that we were working towards. But there were areas where we were a bit too late. And while we were able to build a business which was, you know, unit economics positive, a large enough loan book, but I think we took way too much time. And I think that's where we lost the race.
Right.
And that's the learning that I carried from those days. There's no remorse around it. It's a learning curve that everybody goes through. So that was my learning from my previous startup, which definitely helped in Rupify.
Right. No, I think that's really helpful. Anubhav, I also want to talk about, you know, the fundraising aspect. And you raised your seed round somewhere in March 2020,
uh-huh.
and you know, Series A in 2021, just within a span of a year. So, could you tell us, you know, for a lot of founders who've probably raised their seed and are planning to, you know, raise their Series round, what are the checkboxes as a startup that you need to tick off before even thinking about raising your Series A?
Sure. Yeah, and I think I'm not an expert here, but some things have really helped. Again, part of it past experience from the Kubera days and part of it because of inputs from our early investors. So, you know, if you look at our journey, we started in Jan 2020, then COVID struck, then the first wave happened, and then till our Series A, we were just staring at the second wave in March this year. So we were end-to-end more like a COVID baby, right? Born yeah. and growing during COVID, and that too in MSME lending. So not the best timing, as you would imagine. But what worked for us is also the fact that nobody was even going slightly aggressive in this space. So what we did is when we were sure that this is what we wanted to do, we initially thought that, hey, we will raise kind of $1 million as seed capital and then start to build the company. But when we got our first check, and this was Ashneer from BharatPay, he was an investor in my previous startup. So it's always good, you know, to go to those people who you know very well. And I think that's the learning that I have, is that, you know, your first investors should be those who probably don't even know what you are working on, but they back you because they are backing you as an individual rather than your idea, right? So when I went to Ashneer that I'm starting again, he was, you know, that I'll write your first check. Just make sure that you move fast enough. So what we did is, once we had Ashneer on board, we kept ourselves a target date of 2 weeks. And we said that, hey, now what we'll do is, with Ashneer being there and Ramakant also came on board at the same time. He was an investor in Ankit's previous startup. So both Ankit and I, we did this, I think, one thing right, which is we went to our investors from the past life and we told them that, hey, this is what we plan to do next and would love your support. And they were kind enough to support us. And once we had two good names with us, all we did is reach out to people in our network and we told them that, hey, this is what we're doing. These are the people who have decided to invest in us. And this is the timeline that we have. I think what that really helps do is, to the other person who is looking at you as a potential investment, you are communicating a very clear message that we have this much time to close this transaction. And whatever questions they have, you know, you can do 5 rounds of discussions in that 2 week period, but that's the timeline you have. So you don't leave it hanging in midair for anybody, and you are able to move fast. So we were not able to close that entire 1 million in 2 weeks, but at least what it did is we were able to get money in the bank before the first lockdown happened. And, you know, Dijay, you may be aware that a lot of founders struggled after that first lockdown happened, right? Because nobody had expected anything of that sort. So the good thing was that because we decided to move fast and keep a finite time window, we were able to get money in the bank, and now we could just put our head down and build.
And this was a seed round.
This was the seed round. And that was a very important learning for us, that, you know, your seed round should be as quick as possible, because these are purely people who are betting on you, because your idea will shape up. So we didn't really explain people, you know, how we're going to do it and whether it's going to be big or not. Potential was definitely there. But one thing we were clear is that we knew there was a problem we were solving, and we focused on that. The second big learning that helped us in our journey towards Series A came from this conversation I had with Kunal Shah. So this was in June, and we had the product ready. Okay, so as I said, 6 to 7 weeks we took to get the MVP ready. So our MVP was ready in June. There were these two marketplaces who were ready to go live with us. But then the question we had in mind was, is this the right time? There was all sorts of confusion around the credit guarantee schemes. The government was running moratoriums and all that was announced. And should we really go and onboard new MSME customers and, you know, get ourselves engulfed in all this confusion, or what should we do? Right? Nobody was lending at that time. Everybody had stopped. All banks and NBFCs had completely turned off their taps for MSME.
Yeah.
So I knew that we this was an opportunity for us, but we were still kind of contemplating. And that was the time when I messaged Kunal Shah that, hey, I wanted to have a couple of minutes chat. And it was hardly 2 minutes, Digjay, honestly. So All I asked him is that, hey, what do you think? We have a customer ready to go live. We have the MVP ready. But is this the right time for us to do it, considering all this uncertainty around the businesses and SMEs struggling? And he said just one thing. He said, Anubhav, you really can't learn unless you decide to learn by going out in the market. And that was it. We launched next week. The good thing was, with these two marketplaces, there was nobody else going live or running at that time. So we kind of got a preferred partner status in a very short period of time. And then there was no looking back. These two marketplaces literally, Digjay, you know, were the ones who were part of all our investor discussions. All the investors that I spoke to for my Series A, I just had to do one thing. I just had to give them the reference of these two marketplaces that, hey, why don't you go and speak to them and understand what Rupify has done for them. And I think that really helped, because these are two large names in the country. And if, you know, somebody who's a unicorn marketplace in the country tells a potential investor that, hey, a six-month-old startup called Rupify has helped us offer credit to our customers in a completely digital, seamless way, the way we could never have imagined, I think that creates that positive story for you to raise your next round.
Absolutely.
So I think we could very clearly convey the story that we had with two very solid examples, especially because we are in B2B space, right? These customer references were golden for us. So I think that really helped us get there, even though, you know, there were not too many pure credit or lending companies who were able to raise money during this entire 12-month period. But we were able to do it because I think our customers spoke very positively about us. And that was only because we were present for them when nobody else was even thinking about it. So I think those decisions you have to take. I think my learning is that sometimes you have to find opportunity in crisis. And we could see that opportunity. I mean, it's good to have investors who can help you identify that. You'll always need support. I think I've always said that founders need to be completely shameless and ask for help wherever they get stuck. You can't have all the answers. So we went to people like Ramakant, Ashneer, Kunal for help. And all we got was some direction that we could think about, follow, and it really worked for us.
Right. So leading up to, you know, the Series A, strong customer references, very strong angel investors. Those are the two very important criteria that help you and bias to action, of course, to get to your Series A round.
Yeah.
And I want to talk about, you know, the aspect of choosing your Series A investors again, which is tricky, right? Founders may be in different position based on the traction they have. Not everyone might be in the position to be able to, you know, pick and select investors for the growth round.
Yeah.
So tell us about, you know, your approach and, you know, what were you basically optimizing for when you were, you know, choosing your investors or pitching to specific investors for the Series A round? And what role did your seed stage investors play in helping you make that decision?
Sure. So I think I'll answer the second question first. I think the investors we have on board in our Series A were all through connects that our seed investors did. We never had to go out in the market actively to raise money. And we are very fortunate about that, because at one point we were having around a dozen conversations with some of the top institutional investors in the country, and all through connects that people in our seed round were making for us. So I think that's one thing that really helped, that people who were backing us from day one continued to support us, get better connects in the investor communities. So all our current round investors came through them. Second, I think, yeah, as you rightly said, it's not always a situation where founders really get to choose between who they want to work with in terms of investors or who do they really want on cap table. And we also had our tough times. I mean, from the time that we launched the MVP to the time we closed the series, there was a 3 to 4 month period when we were having conversations. But I mean, you know, it was taking its own sweet time because there was still no clarity around where MSME lending as a space was going or how the government was creating different schemes around it. What was the mandate around all these credit guarantee and moratoriums? So everybody was playing a wait and watch kind of a game. Right? But when things started to settle down, I think that was the time when it all started moving very fast. There was a time that, you know, we had multiple interests and we were kind of oversubscribed. And that is the point where there were two things that we decided we will look at to identify the right set of investors we want to work with. One is those investors which could not just help us with money or capital, but with strong support in growing our business. And, you know, this is something founders have to be smart about and figure out. When we were receiving interests or final approval or go ahead in terms of term sheet from different investors, I think we had a very, very clear conversation with some of them. And we asked them that, hey, it's great to have the capital coming from an institution like you, but we also would like to understand, you know, where all can we expect support in our day-to-day business? Is it getting the right talent? Is it getting these right anchor partnerships? Is it getting connects to, let's say, banks or NBFCs to get supply side capital? Where, you know, do we see more support coming? And based on those conversations, I think founders will have to take a, you know, informed decision as to where they can do a careful match of the right investor. And there's no good or bad here. It's just that what is your topmost priority? Is capital the thing that helps you succeed? And there are certain businesses where, you know, capital matters the most, right? Founders know how to execute, where to execute. They know exactly what they're doing. It's just a capital raising game. And then there are certain businesses where you need everything. Like in our case, we need demand side support. We need supply side support. We also will continuously need to hire the right talent across operations, collections, risk, product, engineering. So there's a whole lot we have to evaluate. So we put everything together and then decided, you know, who are the best people for us to work with when it comes to all of this. And I think that really helped us, you know, identify a good stream of investors for us in the A round.
Right. No, I think that's a very good perspective, you know, especially for founders that have raised their seed, but are now, you know, in the next phase where they're trying to scale up, you know, going to MVP and also looking to raise the next round.
Yep.
And, you know, to optimize for some of these factors that you mentioned, just help them accelerate their overall journey to, you know, scale their business. So it's important to bring those considerations in when you're pitching to investors and, you know, closing that round.
Yeah.
So one last question, Anubhav, before we, you know, move to our final segment, which is the rapid fire.
Sure.
Having been a founder, you know, for quite a few years now across three different startups, how has it shaped you as an individual? What have you learned about yourself and what were the key positives of being a founder over the years?
Yeah, sure. I think positives of being a founder is you tend to enjoy the kind of balance you create in having the right risk appetite, but also making sure that the risk that you are taking is all calculated. It's never an infinite risk, right? I think there is a lot of discussion that happens around what it takes to start up and there's so much risk somebody is taking, but that risk is never, I mean, it can always be quantified. So I think that's the part I love where whatever decisions I take now in personal life also, I try to quantify the pros and cons of any decision that I have. So that's something that really helped me as an individual as well. What I've learned about myself being a founder is that I think there are areas where one can delegate and there are areas where one can completely own different pieces of a problem. And to carefully, you know, strike a balance between these two is the most critical thing. If I look at myself 5 years back, I think that was an area where I made blunders in terms of what I should be doing and what I should maybe have a co-founder with complementary skill doing or some team member with the right skill doing versus today, where I know exactly my limitations and where I need to delegate to somebody else. So that is something that I have really learned over the last few years.
Awesome. Well, thanks for sharing that, Anubhav. Like a lot of founders say, starting up is a journey of self-discovery, and there's so much to learn about yourself while you're on that journey.
Yeah.
So with that, Anubhav, I want to quickly move to our final segment, the rapid fire round. I'll shoot some questions and hope to get your immediate thoughts on the same.
Sure.
Okay. First question: one thing that you'd like to change to improve the state of the Indian startup ecosystem today?
I think the amount of paperwork that one needs to go through for any kind of a legal or compliance activity, that can definitely change it. It's so, so painful compared to, let's say, more evolved markets like China or US.
If you had to give a TED talk, what topic would you choose and why?
So as a risk person, and since I also spoke about just now, I think my topic would be that be ready to take risk, because every single risk can be quantified and can be measured. And I can take financial services examples there, where I can talk about how we measure and quantify credit risk, but otherwise as well, in your work, in your personal life. I think that's something that's close to me.
VCs and founders from the ecosystem that you admire and look up to?
Okay. VCs, I think I spoke about some of the people who have really helped us. If you ask me one name, I think Ashneer has definitely been of super help right from day one. And I think I admire the way he's built up BharatPay and continues to build that company going forward. It's amazing to see that happen. Founders that I admire, I mean, there are plenty. But a few of them, if you ask me, I think I really admire from the past decade what Sanjeev Bikhchandani had built. At that time when Indian startup ecosystem was almost nowhere and nothing, to build a company like Info Edge at that point is something I really, really find very inspiring.
Awesome. Thanks, Anubhav. And any final thoughts for current and aspiring founders that are listening to you today?
No, I think thanks for having me. And the only thought I have is if anybody is looking to, deciding on starting up or wants to be a founder, I think there is no better time than right now. There will never be a better time than right now.
Anubhav, it was, an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thanks for taking out time, and hopefully we'll have you on the show soon again.
Pleasure was all mine. Thank you so much, Dikshay.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of the VC Bruno podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please let our guest know about it, share your thoughts on social media, and let them know what were your key takeaways. We would truly appreciate if you could subscribe to our podcast on the podcast platform of your choice and leave us a review on Apple iTunes. This will help others discover the podcast. To get insights and to learn more about startups and venture capital, you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram. We will love to hear from you there. You can find all episodes together on our website, thevcpreneur.com. We will be back again next week with another VCpreneur that is making a dent in the venture universe. Until then, take care and keep shining.